Special Radio Boston. I'm Adam Ragusea.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. I'm here too.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And we're all back together in the studio to take a look back at Radio Boston 2010.
And Meghna, by the way, like, where have you been for the last 4 months?
I've actually been on maternity leave with our first child and been having, I'll admit, a fantastic time.
Well, it's great to have you back.
And Meghna, one of the close to last interviews you did before you left, and one of the most noteworthy, was with Supreme Judicial Court Chief Justice Margaret Marshall. You spoke with her just shortly after she had announced her retirement from the court.
That's right. In fact, Adam and I went down to the John Adams Courthouse to speak with her. And most people will remember Chief Justice Marshall as being the woman who decided the Goodridge case
sure.
in Massachusetts. Of course, that's the case that legalized same-sex marriage here. But what most people might not know about her is that she was raised in South Africa. She was an anti-apartheid activist as a student there. But she told us something really fascinating, that when she was young, she never actually thought she was going to be a lawyer, let alone a history-making one.
I find it amazing that, you know, I'm speaking with a woman who tells us that she never intended to even go into the study of law, that you wanted to be an art historian.
That's correct.
So how is it that you got seduced by the law?
Well, what I love to tell especially recent college graduates is, if you're not quite sure about what you want to be, don't worry. I went to law school when I was 29, and believe me, when you're 22, that feels ancient. I feel very lucky that I discovered law. I actually went to law school because I had made the decision to remain in the United States, and I went to law school again, not really thinking about becoming a lawyer, but because I wanted to learn more about the American legal system and the American historical system. And I was about as naive about what happened in law school. I didn't know any lawyers, not one lawyer in Massachusetts. I didn't know any judges. I was a complete novice. And as I look back on this, what I've been able to do, I mean, this is an amazing country. And luck played a great role as well, I'm sure.
In our discussion here, I'm very mindful that I am speaking with a sitting judge, and judges always try, or at least attempt, to maintain this sense of balance and not be political.
That's correct.
But on the other hand, there are people out there who see you as having been a liberal force on the bench here in Massachusetts. For example, in 2005, you were at Brandeis University at its commencement, and there was a hall, I believe, of blue and white balloons, and you were overheard saying, "No red states here," because there were no red balloons there, and you later had to apologize for that.
I apologized willingly, and I regretted that comment, and I still do.
So, I mean, do you find that it's difficult then to be a judge and yet also have whatever convictions a judge may have as a citizen or as, you know, as an individual residing in the state and country that they live in?
The interesting thing is, there have been several press reports since I've announced my intention to retire describing me as a lifelong Democrat, which I'm not. I have never been a Democrat. I have been a registered independent for decades. But beyond that, the thing that has been most important to me is that everybody who comes to this court, and any court in Massachusetts, feel as well as realize that they will be viewed impartially by every judge before whom they appear. It's not that difficult a discipline to learn, that you simply put aside your own personal views, listen to the arguments, and rule on the basis of what the law requires.
In thinking back to your time in South Africa, it occurs to me that, you know, you were, as we were talking about, a young woman there and growing up, and then a student activist in the 60s. But it really wasn't until the late 80s and 1990 in particular, when Nelson Mandela was freed from prison, and then President F.W. de Klerk, I believe, started negotiations to dismantle the system of apartheid. So several decades later, that apartheid truly came to an end. And it wasn't the law that managed to make those changes. It seems like it was more sort of politics, policy, and maybe the force of public opinion. So I wonder, in the end, looking upon that example, and there's many others to choose from as well, but do you see the law actually as an inadequate tool to affect change in societies?
That's a very broad question. I think it depends what basis you're starting from. If you're starting from a totalitarian fascist government, as South Africa was, the law was being used as an instrument of oppression. So I think it would have been unreasonable for people to appeal to the law, although in fact Nelson Mandela and the heads of the African National Congress often did attempt to take their claims to courts of law. It was only when they were resoundly defeated that they turned to other means. I think what we were seeing at the beginning of the 21st century is how much people long for that stability of the rule of law. And in the United States, we're certainly not a perfect society, but over the past several hundred years, we have gradually developed a rule of law, which I think has stood us in very good stead.
That was then Chief of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, Margaret Marshall, talking with Radio Boston's Meghna Chakrabarty. And Marshall has since retired from the bench and has been replaced by Chief Justice Roderick Ireland. Meghna, I actually went down with you and helped you record that interview at the John Adams Courthouse that day. And the thing that I really remember was that a few days later, we got these like beautiful handwritten thank you notes from her. And for someone from my generation, that's a pretty foreign ritual.
Oh, that she didn't tweet her thanks to you?
Exactly. But you know, I could understand her doing it for you, but she sent one to me, and I was literally just the guy holding the microphone. And I thought about that later, and I was like, you know what? You don't get to that kind of a station in life unless you care about relationships. And I think that's what that is. That's a manifestation of caring about relationships.
Well, everyone that we met who worked with Chief Justice Marshall that day described her as being eminently gracious, and I think that was part and parcel of what we experienced in meeting her. But with the elevation of now Chief Justice Ireland as the first African-American Chief Justice on the Supreme Judicial Court, another history-making year at the SJC.
Indeed, indeed. So, Sasha, let's talk about this one cool interview that you did.
Right. This is with Jill Lepore. Many people know her as a writer for The New Yorker, but she's also a historian at Harvard. She actually teaches undergraduate history. And she just put out a new book called The Whites of Their Eyes, The Tea Party's Revolution and the Battle Over American History. And we talked about how many modern-day Tea Party movements, the modern-day Tea Party movements and other recent Tea Party movements have really used the historical Tea Party as their inspiration. You write in your book that the movement is anti-historical in your view. In what way?
I think what's slightly different about it now is that since the 1970s, we've seen the rise of heritage tourism, for one thing. You know, you can't walk down State Street without bumping into a reenactor and someone on the Freedom Trail wearing their tri-cornered hat and their breeches. And, you know, I teach an undergraduate research seminar on the revolution at Harvard, and it's always a blast to take students on field trips. But, you know, I'm wandering around trying to take them to burying grounds, and you're competing for space with, you know, people dressed up as Ben Franklin. So there's that. The whole gamut of heritage tourism is to tell American history as a kind of comic book and to kind of collapse the distance between now and then. Oh, if we just dress up like them, we'll be like them. But the other piece of it is there's been a lot of influence in American politics, especially since the Reagan Revolution in 1980, of evangelicals and particularly fundamentalists in American politics. And one of the things that a lot of those people have argued is that we need to think about the Constitution the same way we think about the Bible, that it is a document that transcends time, that was divinely inspired, that the Founding Fathers were prophets. And a lot of that sensibility is part of the Tea Party. I mean, there are many elements to it, but I think the way that the Tea Party thinks about the past amounts to a variety of fundamentalism.
You say that asking what the Founding Fathers would do is like asking a NASA scientist what Isaac Newton would do.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like we don't care about what Isaac Newton had to say. Of course, we care, but do we take our direction from him? The other analogy that I try to draw is, if you think about the relationship between creationism and evolutionism, historical fundamentalism and historical scholarship bear about that same relationship. They're fundamentally different ways of thinking about the past. They have a very different set of premises from which they proceed. And it happens to be the case that people who have argued for the teaching of creationism in the schools have also argued recently for the teaching of what's called providential history, which is basically this, that the founding of the United States was divinely inspired, that the country was founded as a Christian nation, that the Constitution is a sacred document. And, of course, there are many ways of thinking about the past. The problem with it, as far as I'm concerned, is, well, then any political argument has a whole side that's incontrovertible. I mean, then to argue against these people is to be uttering blasphemy. And that is, I think, behind some of the heated rhetoric of this particular political moment.
You say in your book that Thomas Paine, is sort of an odd character in history, and many people don't know whether to claim him or throw him away.
Yeah, Paine is one of these great, you know, and I always say in the comic book version of American history, Paine is Aquaman. You know, they only call him in when they need somebody who can swim. You know, you don't actually know. How did Aquaman get to be Aquaman? He doesn't even have a backstory. He doesn't even have, like, a secret identity. He's just always in his Aquaman costume. And Payne is sort of like that. He kind of drifts in and out of whether he's really in the pantheon of founding fathers. And most people think about Payne, they think about Common Sense. Just wonderful, brilliant, brilliant essay. Payne, of course, went on and wrote The Rights of Man in England and wrote The Age of Reason. In France, he considered these three books, Common Sense, The Rights of Man, and The Age of Reason, as a trilogy. And The Age of Reason is an argument against established religion. You know, Payne famously said, you know, my own mind is my own church. I mean, he really, it's not that he didn't have faith, but he did not believe in any church, Christian, Muslim, Jewish. And this is a piece of Payne that Americans on the right often choose to forget, and Americans on the left really want to remember. And this, so Glenn Beck published a book called Common Sense recently, cherishing Payne. Beck is not someone who would endorse Payne's religious views, but Payne's religious views are so ill known at this point that he can be used even by someone who feels very passionately about the need for expressed Christianity in political life.
That was Harvard historian Jill Lepore with her views on the Tea Party movement. She spoke with Radio Boston host Sasha Pfeiffer.
And interestingly, the thing about that conversation that got our listeners really talking afterward online was not the content, but rather Jill Lepore's voice. So here's John Erickson commenting at WBUR.org/Boston. The author has valuable and important things to say, but her periodic giggles and laughing diminish her message and strike the average person as condescending and elitist.
And Adam, that comment surprised me so much because Jill Lepore obviously delights in what she does. This woman loves history, and I think her laughing and her spirit show how much she loves what she does. Now, we did actually have other people, I think, jump into her defense.
Absolutely. So here's D.D. Burns writing, I too felt Miss Lepore discussed an important issue, but unlike the previous comment, I thoroughly enjoyed her delivery. It's clear that she is passionate about history and sharing her knowledge. I felt as though I was sitting in on an engaging conversation between friends while I listened to the show.
And that's what I felt like talking to her. Like it was a conversation between two people, including with someone who just really loved what she did.
You know, one of the things we do on Radio Boston is celebrate the accomplishments of well-known folks in our community, and sometimes we do that on the occasion of their deaths.
Yes, and we also had a few opportunities to remember some people who, while maybe they weren't hugely famous, they were still very accomplished. And one story like that is of a young girl who succumbed to cancer. Her name was Esther Earle.
Right. Esther was just a teenager. She was from Quincy, but after she got sick, she was confined to her home for much of the rest of her life. But she started a video blog that let her stay connected to her friends and actually let her create a lot more friendships. Here's Esther giving a video tour of her bedroom, which had been moved to the first floor of her family's house after she could no longer climb stairs.
And this used to be a dining room, but now it's my bed, and now it's my lamp, and now it's my bookshelf, and now it's my Harry Potter shrine. Archie Comics shrine? Does anybody know Archie Comics?
Her online presence attracted attention from around the world. And when she died at the age of 16, tributes to her on YouTube started pouring in.
Esther, I didn't know you personally. Even if I didn't meet you, you were such an inspiration to me and so many other people.
I'm gonna miss her. That light, that spark is just gone.
Esther was an amazing kid. She was astonishingly empathetic. She was really thoughtful. She was very funny.
I spoke with Esther's parents, and here's her mom, Lori Earle, talking about how Esther approached her disease.
I think somebody said the other day that Esther was probably always an old soul. So she had a lot of wisdom even as a kid. I mean, we loved to hear her say things. We have videos of her as a kid talking about the angels. But I think that she would say herself, because, you know, she has one of her videos, she talks about her feelings, and she talks about hating her cancer, but then how can she hate something that made her who she was? And so she was Esther, and she just embraced the good and the bad together.
I'm not always this perfect person. I get pissed. I do stupid things. I hate my cancer. I sometimes wish I've never gone through this. And then I realize that if that happened, I wouldn't be who I am. And then I get all like, oh, that's just confusing. But then sometimes I do wish it never happened, the cancer thing.
That was a YouTube video of 16-year-old Esther Earle, who died earlier this year at the tender age of 16. Radio Boston's Sasha Pfeiffer spoke with Esther's parents, Wayne and Lori Earle.
Well, we've got to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll talk about some of the wonderful folks from the Boston arts community that we've had the opportunity to meet this year.
One of whom was Charles Ansbacher. He's a world-famous conductor and the founder of the Boston Landmarks Orchestra. He actually passed away in September. But when we spoke with him, Ansbacher told us that he founded the Landmarks Orchestra in an effort to bring classical music out of the stuffy performance hall and right into the heart of the greater Boston community. A truly great Bostonian. And here's Charles Ansbacher conducting Beethoven's Seventh in Russia.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. This is Radio Boston.